Hello there and welcome. Today is Monday. And I am sure it is Monday. No, it is Tuesday, March the 6th. And this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump doubles down on trade.
Our country on trade has been ripped off by virtually every country in the world, whether it's friend or enemy, everybody.
The White House welcomes Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the Dreamers come to Washington. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump Monday said the U.S. is not backing down on its decision to impose 25% tariffs on steel imports and 10% tariffs on imported aluminum. Trump's decision has also drawn strong condemnation from some in his own Republican Party and from U.S. trading partners around the world. European Commission President threatened the European Union could respond by taxing American-made products such as bourbon, whiskey, blue jeans, and even Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And to this, Trump responded,
"Our country on trade has been ripped off by virtually every country in the world, whether it's friend or enemy. Everybody, China, Russia, and take people that we think are wonderful, the European Union. We can't do business in there. They don't allow. They have trade barriers that are worse than tariffs."
Analysts warned the tariffs will hurt many U.S. allies, and Germany and France now say they'll bring forward plans to introduce a common corporation tax system in response to Trump's tariff. Joining us now to discuss is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. What do you make of what's happening here?
Angela Merkel has finally put together a coalition. So she's going to be having her government back up and running this week. And that has given Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, the impetus to get back together with Emmanuel Macron, the French president, and to bring together a very powerful pro-EU Franco-German relationship that can stand up together as a united front against Donald Trump. One of the first areas where they're looking at doing this is indeed when it comes to corporate taxation. Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron want a joint corporate taxation to go right across Europe if possible, but if that's not possible, just in France and Germany. And that will mean that they'll be able to impose that and they'll be able to compete for American companies to come to those countries. So that will make it easier, better for American companies to base themselves in Europe and will not, of course, these American companies will not be tempted to go back to the U.S. So that's important there. They want that.
Mm-hmm.
By getting them together, by having this strong Franco-German alliance means that they can, if you like, have the two personalities working on getting the right message to Donald Trump's ear. You've got, on the one hand, you've got Angela Merkel. She's very much on the quiet side. She's very much sort of quiet diplomacy, picking up the phone, talking. On the other side, you have Emmanuel Macron, who's very much a sort of, if you like, a bit of a machismo at the moment. He knows he's the guy on the block. He is the guy that all the countries come and talk to because they feel that he's got a seat at the UN Security Council, they're in NATO, they're the big player in the EU, that Emmanuel Macron is big, people listen to him. So what they're doing is they're trying to show Donald Trump that not only are they united, they are united and that together they have the European Union behind them, which means that they can match his tax cuts, they can impose tariffs if they want to, and they can also stand up and side with Iran on the Iran nuclear deal. So that's what they're trying to prove to Donald Trump.
How unprecedented is all of this, given that these are some of the U.S.'s strongest allies and these concerns over global trade war?
The concern over the trade war is really, it really did have the needle in the red over the weekend, to the point where you had a former head of the WTO describing Donald Trump's vision of world trade as being medieval. I mean, this is something that's really of great concern to them. And so for countries whose modern history is steeped in a respect for America. That people here do not forget that America came to help Europe First World War and in the Second World War, and with rebuilding Europe after the Second World War, it's really unprecedented. If you think about Cold War, Europe relied on the American security umbrella for all those years of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
It relied on the Marshall Fund to get the European economies up and running to the point they are now, where they can actually punch on an even level with the United States.
The Iran thing that you mentioned, what's the biggest concern for the Europeans?
The biggest concern is that in May, the U.S. President Donald Trump will say, deal's off. The criteria have not been met. And again, when you look at Germany and France and the European Union invested so much in getting this deal on the table, they realize it's not a perfect deal at the moment, but they'd rather have that deal. For France, it's very important because France has got now a lot of trade with Iran. They've got, they're big on selling them cars and on pharmaceuticals. So what the French president said to his Iranian counterpart this weekend was, you've got to show us that this is working. We'll do our part, but you've got a lot to do. And to reinforce that message, the French president is sending the foreign minister out to Iran, to Tehran, to have talks there this week to get that message across. We'll back you, but you've got to give us evidence that you are working to be open and honest and declare what you have when it comes to questions on your ballistic missile program.
I guess this is quite a bit different than when the President of the United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, because that was sort of more symbolic.
It was, but they really, these are the two issues that they've really struggled to find common ground on. That's the Paris Climate Accord and the Iran nuclear deal. They really are struggling, and Emmanuel Macron makes no secret of the fact that he's not a big fan of the U.S. President Donald Trump, the way he is acting on foreign policy. But he does make the point that there has to be lines of communication, which is why Emmanuel Macron spends so much time on the phone with Donald Trump.
All right, that's Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Aid convoys have reached Syria's eastern Ghouta, but attacks on rebels continue. Former Russian spy is critically ill after exposure to an unknown substance in Britain. The UN chief appoints former New York Mayor Bloomberg as an envoy for climate action. And Florida state senators vote against arming most classroom teachers. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was at the White House on Monday, and he told U.S. President Donald Trump that Iran must be stopped.
If I had to say what is our greatest challenge in the Middle East to both our countries, to our Arab neighbors, it's encapsulated in one word: Iran. Iran has not given up its nuclear ambitions. It is came out of this nuclear deal emboldened, enriched. Is practicing aggression everywhere, including on our own borders. And I think we have to stop this country that chants death to Israel, death to America. Iran must be stopped. That is our common challenge.
Well, the two leaders sitting alongside each other in the Oval Office, where Trump was talking about being unsuccessful, winning support in the Oval Office for pacts from other signatories like Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia to renegotiate the deal. Trump also talked about his decision to open the U.S. Embassy in Israel prior to the 70th anniversary of the State of Israel's May 14th Independence Declaration, saying he actually may travel there for the opening of it.
We're looking at coming. If I can, I will, but I'll be there again. Israel is very special to me, special country, special people, and I look forward to being there, and I'm very proud of that decision.
Netanyahu effusively praised Trump for making the controversial decision to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to the hilly ancient city, which most countries consider disputed territory, subject to negotiations with the Palestinians. Well, the big winners in Italy's election are a rival pair of populist and stridently anti-European Union political forces, the Five Star Movement and the League. But neither gained enough support to govern the country alone, confirming that negotiations will not be easy to form a new government that can win a confidence vote in parliament. But regardless, Sunday's populist victory is not good news for migrants from Africa or those trying to enter Europe through Italy, as winning factions have been clamoring for measures to stop migration and increase deportations. For VOA, Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
Sunday's populist victory is not good news for migrants from Africa or those trying to enter Europe through Italy, as winning factions have been clamoring for measures to stop migration and increase deportations. The outcome of the vote, which effectively delivered a hung parliament, paves the way for a prolonged period of political instability. And President Sergio Mattarella is not expected to open formal talks on forming a government until early April. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The deadline for resolving the fates of hundreds of thousands of young illegal immigrants known as the Dreamers came and went Monday in the U.S. with no action by Congress or the White House. President Donald Trump announced in September he was ending protection from deportation for the Dreamers by scrapping the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program known as DACA. He gave Congress until March 5th to come up with a better idea or revisit the issue. The Dreamers are young men and women who were illegally brought into the country by their parents as young children, and hundreds of them came to Washington Monday to take a stand.
When President Trump has made his so-called deadline and the courts have extended it, but the Congress has to take some action now and get this thing settled. And I think that they should provide legislation that allows a path to citizenship for these kids who have served the country in so many ways.
White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Monday that it's absolutely terrible Congress failed to act and called the situation pathetic.
It's Congress's job to pass laws, and the president has laid out what he wants to see them. And the sad part is that both Republicans and Democrats don't disagree on most of the merits of this legislation. The fact that they can't actually come together and get something done is pathetic, and now they're using the courts as an excuse. They need to come to work and actually do what they were elected to do.
The Democrats blame Trump and the Republican leadership for failing to pass any immigration bills in the Senate, and Speaker Paul Ryan for not bringing the matter to the House floor. The more than 700,000 young Dreamers are now in no immediate peril of being deported because the Supreme Court declined to rule in January on a lower court ruling that blocks the White House from ending DACA. And this does give Dreamers, whose protections have expired, time to reapply for a 2-year extension. Well, from a shopping center in an airport to a concert venue or even your own phone, these are all places facial recognition technology can now be used due to technological advances in the last few years. The types of applications are growing in a world where the idea of privacy is constantly evolving. VOA's Elizabeth Lee explains.
From China to the United States, facial recognition technology is being used and tested like this at the Los Angeles International Airport.
We're always looking at technology processes, even doctrine changes on how to better our security at an airport.
We're going to put that one face down.
This pilot program that takes a picture of the passenger and compares it to the passport picture is just one way facial recognition technology can be used for security.
For the surveillance, you can catch the face in the public and find what you want to find. And for the commercial use, you can find the VIP when they come to a store. So you can make a special server for them.
Great advances have been made in facial recognition technology in recent years. This promotional video shows how it can identify a missing child.
Computers are finally fast enough. We have GPUs and hardware that is fast enough to process all the data that we need to process.
Machines can now match faces even when the lighting isn't good or when a full shot of the face is not available. A side shot or moving image of the face may be enough for artificial intelligence to make a match. Face First is one of many companies developing facial recognition software with endless possible applications.
Where this is going is very exciting. So, you know, we think about everyday items that we have that are going away. Our house keys, our car keys, our ATM cards, our passwords are all starting to go away, and instead we're going to be using facial recognition. Smartphones, of course, now are using facial recognition. Laptops have facial recognition on it.
The ability to capture an image of a person without consent comes with privacy concerns. The worry in the U.S. is not necessarily about the government.
My biggest privacy concern is actually not the government. It's the big companies where there are really no limits on how they can share data, what they can use it for, how they can exploit it.
Facial recognition researchers say a social framework should be created to guide the use of this technology so it can be used safely to benefit society and not exploit it. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the fantasy film The Shape of Water earned four Oscars at the Academy Awards Sunday evening, including Best Picture.
This creature is intelligent, capable of language, of understanding emotions.
Well, the film brought Mexican director Guillermo del Toro the Oscar for Best Director and also won honors for its original score and production design. Mike O'Sullivan reports from Los Angeles that the theme of inclusion really dominated the awards in a year when many in Hollywood have rallied behind women. Audio excerpts, by the way, courtesy of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
Frances McDormand was named Best Actress for her role as a mother who was determined to shame a local sheriff into finding her daughter's killer in Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. As she accepted her Oscar, McDormand asked other women nominees to stand, including actress Meryl Streep.
Meryl, if you do it, everybody else will. Come on. The filmmakers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the cinematographer, the composers, the songwriters, the designers.
She said each of those women has stories to tell and projects that need financing. A recurring theme through the evening, allegations of sexual harassment and assault against a growing number of men in Hollywood. The movie mogul Harvey Weinstein, the subject of scores of accusations, was expelled from the Movie Academy in October. Many in the audience wore the black and white pins of the Time's Up movement, which provides legal help for women abused in the workplace. Others wore orange ribbons and pins to call attention to gun violence following the killings last month of 17 people at a Florida high school. Another theme of the evening, the transformative power of films. Accepting the Oscar for Best Director, filmmaker Del Toro said that films remove barriers.
Because I think that the greatest thing our art does and our industry does is to erase the lines in the sand. We should continue doing that when the world tells us to make them deeper.
Jordan Peele achieved a first for an African-American filmmaker as he accepted an Oscar for the original screenplay of Get Out, a genre-bending horror film about an interracial couple.
I thought it wasn't going to work. I thought no one would ever make this movie. But I kept coming back to it because I knew if someone let me make this movie, that people would hear it and people would see it. So I want to dedicate this to all the people who raised my voice.
Gary Oldman was named Best Actor for his role as Britain's wartime Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, in Darkest Hour, which also earned the Oscar for makeup. Another wartime epic, Dunkirk, won awards for film editing, sound editing, and mixing. Alison Janney was named Best Actress for the biographical film I, Tonya, in which she played the mother of controversial skater Tonya Harding. Sam Rockwell earned the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for his role as a racist policeman in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Coco, a Pixar film set in Mexico, was named Best Animated Feature and also earned an Oscar for Original Song. A Chilean film about a transgender woman called A Fantastic Woman was named Best Foreign Language Film. Icarus, about the Russian doping scandal that led to Russia's ban from this year's South Korean Olympics, was named Best Documentary Feature. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And joining us now for a look at some of the latest movies to hit theaters this year, we are joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, Oscar's behind us now. Let's talk about this latest one, Death Wish. I'm assuming that it involves a lot of violence.
Well, you know, this is the remake of the Charles Bronson film from 1974, and a lot of people have criticized a good guy, white privileged man, going out with a gun, you know, doing street justice, vigilanteism. Is that what we need in the wake of the Parkland shootings and all these shootings going on, that, you know, people taking the law into their own hands?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, but, you know, so that's one of the criticisms going on right now. But you know what? It is a remake of, you know, the Bronson film, but it's been updated. You know, Bruce Willis plays Paul Kersey, who is a Chicago surgeon turned vigilante because his family had a home invasion on his birthday of all days. He's at the hospital doing something. The wife gets killed, played by Elizabeth Shue, and the daughter's in a coma. They both got shot. So he just regresses, you know, of course, as anyone would do, you know, that he doesn't even go into his house. He stays in the basement. And then one day he wants to stop some woman being assaulted in the alley. So he goes to buy a gun, defend himself. But instead of that, he goes out and starts just randomly finding people doing bad things and serving up street justice. So the movie just tries to answer every time he does one of his, you know, his shootings to kind of just like, where do you come down on? What is the right answer? And of course, now what's different in this one than the original was social media, you know, so every time he does one of these acts, he's being videoed, you know, and he's putting up on YouTube and on Instagram and Snapchat, so it becomes a social media star. So the movie's very pro-gun, it's very murdered, it's for justice, you know, the right-wing banner is being carried in this movie. It's like a first-person shooting fantasy. And I have to admit, Lori, I hate saying this, but I got caught up in the bloodlust. You know, it was a guilty pleasure. People were cheering when he was shooting people that were, you know, rapists. Or, you know, there's a scene in the movie where the guy's a drug dealer selling drugs to children. He's called the Ice Cream Man. And he walks up and he goes, you know, who are you? And he goes, your last customer. And just unloads his gun on him in front of 50 people. And people were cheering. I got caught up into it. I'm like, it's a movie and I'm a coward. And, you know, so I just thought, go get him, Doc.
Wow. Sounds so violent.
It is. But it's Death Wish. I mean, just think about
what
that's
true.
Of movie that
that's
is.
The yeah, title. So. The title is Death Wish. What do you expect?
Yes,
death.
It'll find its audience. Trust
it
me.
Absolutely will. All right. Well, we've got the Russian spy movie. This looks very intriguing. Red Sparrow with Jennifer Lawrence. Did you like it?
Well, Red Sparrow, you weren't expecting an Atomic Blonde kind of movie, a Jason Bourne movie, because, you know, she's a Russian spy and you're waiting to see gadgets. You're waiting to see kind of, you know, action sequences like you've seen in those previous films. But it's not. It's a cerebral thriller, as they call it, you know, and there's no action. There's no gadgets, where Jennifer Lawrence plays a Russian ballet dancer who gets an injury during a performance and it ends her career. So her cousin works for the KGB and shows up and says, look, we'll take care of you. We'll take care of your sick mother. You don't have to worry about money and where to live. But we need you to go to Red Sparrow School, which is a school that uses women and men to manipulate their targets with their bodies and their minds. So essentially, the school teaches them to be sluts. Can you
believe
that? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't think of any more PC word to say than that. Because I was really surprised at Jennifer Lawrence's performance, because the nudity, the sexual connotations with it, I thought it was demeaning.
Really?
I thought it was trashy. I thought it had fake female empowerment.
Wow.
I was embarrassed for her.
Wow.
You know? Yeah, I really was. Terrible Russian accents. You know, there was double-crossing going back and forth. Joel Edgerton plays the CIA agent that falls for her, that tries to convince her to come over to America, and I'm on your side. You never knew what was real or what was going on, and not in a cool, exciting Hitchcock kind of way. So the movie does not work. So all of her nudity and all of that, just real disgusting. It was really degrading for her, and I was embarrassed. I really was. I really didn't like this movie.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, you heard it here. Find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, that does it for today's International Edition. Thanks so much for joining us. Find us anytime at VOAnews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Through the efforts of the Iraqi Armed Forces, the Syrian Democratic Forces, and the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, ISIS has been defeated in Iraq and nearly so in Syria. Its self-proclaimed capitals have fallen, and its false caliphate is no more. But that does not mean that the terrorist group and its vicious ideology are no longer a threat to the global community. As we defeat ISIS on the battlefield, the group has adapted to our success, said Ambassador at Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales at the recently held International Conference on Mobilizing Law Enforcement Efforts to Defeat ISIS. The fight is by no means over. It's simply moving into a new phase. Battle-hardened terrorists are heading home from the war zone or wreaking havoc in third countries. Homegrown terrorists, people who are inspired by ISIS but have never set foot in Syria or Iraq, are carrying out attacks. And that means that in most cases, the brunt of the effort to keep the terrorists in check is shifting away from the military and toward civilian measures, including law enforcement, intelligence sharing, diplomatic engagement, messaging, and foreign assistance. Many of the counterterrorism steps the global community is already taking in this direction are enumerated in UN Security Council Resolution 2396, which was adopted in December. These measures include a watch list of known and suspected terrorists, information sharing, including of passenger name records, prosecutions of fighters returning from the battlefield and those inspired by ISIS, and designations to cut off the flow of money to terrorist organizations and their members. In addition, each country should take advantage of Interpol's databases that will fill in the gaps in domestic watch lists. All countries should enact laws that cover and penalize a wide range of terrorist activities. These are the tools prosecutors need to handle the next phase of the ISIS threat. And finally, all countries must develop the necessary legal regimes to designate and sanction terrorists, thus allowing the global community to cut off their financing. My hope, said Ambassador Sales, is that this conference will help us focus our attention on achieving the enduring defeat of this depraved terrorist organization, as well as Al-Qaeda and self-directed terrorists who were inspired by these groups.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.